Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you. Welcome to the Damage Report, everybody. It is, of course, a somber day, as it is across the country, the anniversary of the attacks of 9/11, which we will be talking about at the close of this episode. We'll be recounting our experiences back on that day and reflecting a little bit on what has happened in this country in the far more than a decade that has happened since that attack. But much, much more on the show as well. We're going to be starting off with some of the excerpts from Bob Woodward's book, Fear. It is now available. We have a copy. I have not read it yet, but we do have a little bit of what is revealed in that book. And then after we move on from that, global warming, what do people think needs to be done about it? And how does it break down along racial lines? We have some fascinating data for you. And in the second half of the show, we're going to be joined by Wesley Bell, who just won the Democratic primary for St. Louis's county prosecutor position. And thanks to no Republican opposition, he is likely to become that county prosecutor. We're going to be talking a bit about the needed reforms in that area in terms of criminal justice. So it should be a fascinating interview a little bit later on. For that, though, I'm joined by Michael Shore of I-24 News. Good to have you back on the show.
Good to be here. Thanks, John.
No, Always good to be here.
Wesley Bell will be an interesting interview. I mean, he's somebody who made his name during Ferguson and has sort of continued. A lot of people, you know, show up for the fight and, not to their discredit, disappear after that and go back to their regular lives. He's someone who is kept going with that mission from Ferguson. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah, and obviously in that region, I mean, that's still, like, it's been 4 years. It's been 4 years, I think.
I thought it was 2014. Yeah, I think you're right, 2014.
But you still see, I mean, the anniversary is a major thing. Like, this is not something that has receded from people's minds. And
except mine, apparently, because I forgot what year it was.
Well, exactly what year.
2014.
But we are constantly reminded of the need for criminal justice reform. We were talking yesterday on the show, Botham Shanjan. New details coming out every day in this shooting where the police, I don't know if you're familiar, officer, yes, in Dallas, now saying that the door was ajar and she shouted commands to him, which many people have responded to. If there's a plainclothes police officer shouting at you when you're in your own home, what obligation are you under to listen to those verbal commands? It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And how do you go from, I repeatedly tried to open the door with my key fob, to the door was ajar, so I investigated it?
It's a better story.
Maybe a better story. But sometimes, though, the first draft is important. Even if you edit it later on.
Right.
And as other people have said, this is a reminder. I think Sean King pointed this out on Twitter. This is a reminder of how important it is that initial police statements after any use of force should be recorded immediately after it happens, and not days later after they've had time to coordinate with their union and their supervisors and all of that to figure out what the story should be. We want the actual facts based on what actually happened. In any event, we'll be talking about those sorts of topics a little bit later on with Wesley Bell. Before that, though, I just want to briefly mention, I saw this came out just before we went live today. The Senate Judiciary Committee is apparently scheduled to vote for this Thursday for Brett Kavanaugh's nomination. As some people have pointed out, that's when the hurricane is expected to hit the coast, so a lot of people probably won't be paying attention. But it also looks like the Democrats will be able to delay that vote for about a week.
By rules, they're allowed to delay it for a week. That's just the rule. So they'll do that, and they'll scramble for a week, and they'll keep trying to bring any Republican over to their side.
Yeah, and it, I mean, so far it doesn't look like there will be one, even though Susan Collins, the fund to pay for a challenger against her is now up to $800,000 if she does vote for Brett Kavanaugh. And there's many people believe that he is literally committing perjury during these nomination hearings, in addition to having done so in previous nomination hearings. And even with all that, you can't scrape two Republicans together to oppose him.
Well, there are Democrats who are trying to do it, not necessarily Susan Collins either. They're going to be going to other Republicans in the hope that the perjury thing, if they can show material evidence, it's so ridiculous to say, not just what we've seen so far, but they want to see material perjured evidence. And if they can get that to a couple of Republicans, I don't know who they are, but I know that they're going after Republicans who are neither Murkowski nor Collins to try and make a change. So, you know, I was thinking about who that might be, and I don't know, but it's interesting.
I don't know either. And, I didn't even intend to talk about Kavanaugh, but obviously it's incredibly important. I think that this is the battle that people in progressive media need to be having. And unfortunately, a lot of the media is just assumed, he's going to get on. Not just during the actual nomination hearings, but for the past couple of months. I think the Sunday talk shows, Media Matters said it was talked about for like 20 seconds or something like that. Yeah. There was just no discussion, even though, again, he's going to hold the position for literally decades. If he commits perjury during the confirmation hearings, that can be shown, and he gets onto the Supreme Court. Is there any hope of impeachment, or is that just crazy?
I mean, there is. You'd have to have a lot more going for you. You'd have to have a Democratic Senate, I would imagine, in order to do that. And, you know, it hasn't been done since 1805. So there's reason to think that it's, you know, there have been other times to do it where it hasn't happened. The problem with Kavanaugh, unlike some of the other justices who haven't been approved, not all of them, is not just judicial temperament. He seems qualified to be a Supreme Court justice on the legal side of it. It's this perjury thing. I mean, his attitudes and everything he says are deplorable, you know, right? And what he hides and what he doesn't represent as well as his ruling. So every progressive should be upset about him. I'm if you have a carpenter who's a Trump supporter, he can still be a good carpenter, and you think he's ridiculous for being a Trump supporter. But this guy's a Supreme Court justice, lifetime appointment. I think when they go after him for perjury, they're going to want to do as much as they can beforehand to set the table for it.
Yeah, perhaps. And that's one of the reasons we're giving so much focus to it. So let's turn now to book releases of the week. We've got one for you. Bob Woodward's, actually. It's called Fear, Trump in the White House. I guess purposefully it's like we're scared, but also Trump is scared.
Right.
Because he's a moron and he's not qualified for the position. And so we already knew a little bit about this. We were talking about it last week, excerpts from the book. There had been allegations. Vanity Fair ran a headline saying that Gary Cohn called Trump's intelligence level that of a inbred tanning bed. But we got the book and we searched it, and there's no reference to that in the book.
Really?
But everybody's reporting it as if that is a quote.
That's
so I don't know what
was
that's
that something
about.
That Woodward said in an interview?
I don't know. But it's on Vanity Fair, and now everybody is running it because it was in Vanity Fair,
right.
Even though it's not in their article and it's not in the book, as far as we can see, anyway. But before we get to the actual references, I do want to tie this to the op-ed, the New York Times op-ed, the continuing hashtag Lodestar scandal. So Carlos Lozada tweeted, in the middle of the Woodward book, I find a Lodestar reference attributed to Wilbur Ross, saying that deficits are the Lodestar. Does this mean it was Wilbur Ross who wrote the op-ed? Do you have a prediction about who it was? We talked about it on the show last week.
I mean, that's great evidence, but
because Penn said also used Lodestar.
Yeah, Penn said too, but Wilbur Ross is the kind of, you know, figure that could potentially be the kind of reasonable-ish person who could talk to a reporter and do this and see firsthand what's going on, especially as the Secretary of Commerce. He's had to deal with so much having to do with the tariffs. He might just be sick of it. Do I have theories? You know, my first theory was Mick Mulvaney, the OMB director, because I know how hard he worked against Trump and for Rubio during the primaries, covering the primaries.
I did not know that, actually.
And but that's politics. A lot of people worked against Trump who are now supporting Trump, people who were even in his White House. So Elaine Chao seemed of particular interest to me, just because she's with Mitch every night, or most nights, and I can't imagine Mitch liking that much, and I could see them sort of thinking about this together, trying to get Republicans back to being Republicans, and then you know I'd like to think Steven Mnuchin, but I don't think it's Steven Mnuchin because he seems bright, and how in the world could he be doing what he's doing for this guy? But like anybody else, I'm just tossing it around, thinking about Dan Coats, right? Everybody's saying DNI, Dan Coats.
That's what my girlfriend thinks.
Yeah. Well, I mean, your girlfriend's right in that, I mean, he was a senator. He's from the classic mold of Republicans. Mm-hmm. He's a party guy. He doesn't have much to lose by being the one to come out and say this. I mean, it's not like he's plotting a future in politics. He's been an accidental senator and a senator twice. So I think that it's...
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, The host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
That's my feeling.
I want your quick reaction. With the time that we have left in this block, the theory that I put forward last week was Pence said Lodestar. Now, he is a crazy ideologue in his own right, but he's done everything he can to step back from Trump. Like, he is his vice president, but he has not been seen in years. And so my theory is he would do this op-ed knowing that if Trump remains popular, nobody ever has to find out that it was him.
Right.
But if Trump tanks, you know, he goes to jail or forced to resign, and it's embarrassing, then he can then reveal, by the way, you know, this whole time I was the one trying to be responsible and sane, and here's this op-ed that proves it.
Right. A lack of fealty in that party is a terrible thing. Mm-hmm. Mike Pence is someone who is more ambitious than the job he has right now. Mm-hmm. For him to go to the New York Times and do something like this is, to me, it's really unbelievable. The risks of having his identity leaked are too high for someone like Mike Pence. Whereas I think some of these other people we've talked about, it's not going to matter to them. But what do I know?
I've noticed the pattern. So far, no one thinks that my theory is any good. So I'm going to hold to it even more strongly in the future.
Do that. Fight hard.
I will. Okay, we're going to take our first break. When we come back, a little bit more from fear, our own, also Bob Woodward's, and then we're going to move on to climate change. Will we do anything about it? And if we don't, who will suffer the most after this? Back, everyone. The Damage Report, John Iderola. Michael Shore is here as well. And let's get some more fear. Bob Woodward's book, Fear, is out. And I have three things from the book that perhaps you should fear. We're going to go over them and see if I can generate that emotion in you. The first was an experience where Gary Cohn was apparently speaking with the president, and he was explaining how during Trump's first term, the Federal Reserve was probably going to raise interest rates. And Donald Trump doesn't have any idea what that means or what effect it would have or what the alternatives are. And that was made clear in an interaction he had with Gary Cohn. So he said to Gary Cohn, "We should just go borrow a lot of money, hold it, and then sell it to make money." This is an excerpt from the book, by the way. This suggestion and lack of basic understanding about how the federal debt works apparently sent chills up the spine of Cohn, who explained that borrowing more money would in fact increase the deficit and add to the debt. Which, of course, for 2 years at this point, Donald Trump had been saying he was going to wipe out the debt during his time as president. Gary Cohn explained this to Trump, who was not concerned about the contradiction between these two things.
Right. Listen, in a way, this book is confirmation of things we knew before the election happened. Mm-hmm. If you watched any of the debates that he had with Secretary Clinton, whatever you thought of either of them, he had no grasp of facts. When there were issues that they were talking about, the really sort of the stuff that was the least sexy in those debates, he was lost. He was completely at sea about this.
Yeah.
And, you know, even there was a time when he talked about who his advisors would be, you know, who the people that he would consider to be his closest advisors. And they were people that nobody had ever heard of. Experts within their own field hadn't even heard of them.
Yeah.
And so there was just this. So I don't find it surprising. You sort of knew a book like this was going to be written eventually. And it's great that Bob Woodward wrote it because he's somebody who's got the gravitas to make that point. But I'm not surprised by any of it. It's a lot of it, you know, your jaw hits the ground because of what it is, and you imagine this guy's the president, but your jaw should have been on the ground for the past 2 years.
So I don't have, obviously, nearly as much experience with Bob Woodward. I know that he's written books about many presidents. What is the chance, the percentage chance, that Bob Woodward is just making a bunch of this up?
I mean, you know, in the end, Bob Woodward's integrity, every single time somebody has doubted him, has always risen, right? Mm-hmm. There have been problems with little things in his books here and there, but I think that's the case with every oral history and every history and every biography. But there's no question that, that's what Ben Bradley said to him, right? You know, that people are going to criticize, but the truth is going to rise to the top. I'm confident that this is true. Yeah. I mean, just from knowing the work that he's done. Some of his tactics over time have been kind of weird. Like, there were times when he wrote a book, I think it was Shadows, which was a book about five presidents, and he talked about the way that, George H.W. Bush walked out onto the White House portico. And he thought this. Well, he didn't interview Bush for that, right? So he didn't know he thought it. Well, it was reported Bush told this to somebody. So it's a little bit secondhand or third hand. This stuff's secondhand. It seems like it's really accurate.
Yeah, I think the idea that he would just tank his entire reputation.
He would never do that. That's the thing. He's not Michael Wolff, right? Mm-hmm. Michael Wolff is a different kind of writer who wrote that book about the White House before, which, I seems fine too. But this is a totally different writer, and this is a real journalist doing real journalism who has done this kind of thing before. So what you just said is true. He wouldn't put it all out there for nothing.
It's Trump saying the entire thing is made up, facing three countervailing arguments. One, obviously the longstanding reputation of Bob Woodward. Two, the fact that everything else coming out of the White House has been saying this same stuff this whole time. And three, that in response to this book, which is totally not true and totally false, they are radically revising their security protocols and not allowing phones in certain areas and not letting people talk to each other, which seems like a really weird reaction to have if none of this was even true in the first place.
Right. And also the refutation of things is something that he does all the time. And most of those things, it turns out that they're right.
And he had previously been quoted, never forget this Trump quote, he said of the media, I'm going to keep attacking you and slamming you so that nobody trusts you when you come out with negative news. He said that, and he's been doing it ever since. Maybe it was the one time he's been honest since he descended that escalator several years ago.
And Richard Nixon was the last person to do this to Bob Woodward, and look what happened. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah. Oh, fingers crossed. Okay, second thing potentially be a little bit worried about. This might be a little bit more for him. So apparently, after learning of news regarding Mueller and Deutsche Bank, involving Mueller getting into this area of investigation, so that Deutsche Bank is a primary lender to the president, a furious Trump phoned John Dowd, one of his lawyers, at 7 a.m., said, I know my relationships with Deutsche Bank. I know what I borrowed, when I borrowed, when I paid it back. I know every GD1, this is bullpuck. So he seemed very scared, fear, in the White House of this potential part of the investigation. I mean, considering all that had been being looked into and all that Mueller was doing, like, he really did seem to freak out about this one thing. And we know that if money laundering was going on, that's something that people have been talking about for several years now, Deutsche Bank probably is involved in it.
Right.
So that might explain his fear.
Which he could just sort of alleviate by just releasing his tax returns, which he's never done. And that's what sort of all this financial inquiry is about. It's about, they assume that what you just said is true, that there was money laundering, that Deutsche Bank was involved, and the president didn't want to reveal that in his tax returns, among other things. I mean, there's speculation about what all of it could have been. This seems so believable, though. I mean, there's nothing outlandish about this, that he's so self-interested that the first thing he would think of would be that.
Yeah.
And how do we, and his ire over that. Surprising at all.
And the last one, by the way, is a tweet that was thankfully pulled apparently by the Pentagon. He had drafted a tweet. This is back when he was in that, social media feud with the leader of North Korea. That's a weird sentence to have to say. But he had drafted a tweet saying, we're going to pull our dependents from South Korea, family members of the 28,000 people there. Apparently, at that moment, there was a sense of profound alarm in the Pentagon leadership that, my God, one tweet and we have reliable information that the North Koreans are going to read this as, quote, an attack is imminent. Because if you're pulling the dependents out, that seems like they would be in danger.
Yeah.
And since North Korea had not attacked, it seems like they'd be put in danger by something the U.S. was going to do. Now, thankfully, that tweet was pulled. We have no idea if that would have actually led to some sort of hostilities. But these are the sorts of things that are just going on behind the scenes. We see through a certain lens, a certain amount of what comes out of the White House. And occasionally something like an Omarosa will happen where we get a little bit of a view inside of it. But this stuff is going on every single day. In the time that we've been broadcasting the show, God only knows what's been happening in the White House.
Right. And the fact that there are tweets that aren't sent, you know, the tweets that are sent make it through some kind of a filter is unbelievable, too, when you think of what is tweeted. I think one of the objectively interesting things about this White House is how the tweet machine works, you know, who vets what, how it gets out there, and that Woodward had access to these unsent tweets or had access to people who would tell him about these unsent tweets is actually some of the history in the book that sounds great. Of course, I haven't read it yet either, but it just sounds – that's the compelling stuff to me, like what goes on in that building and how we end up with what we end up with.
Yeah.
And the tweet stuff is obviously top of the list.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know if more will come out from the book. Obviously, we're going to be reading it. I have a feeling it's probably doing quite well.
They put a million copies into print right away.
Really?
Yeah, a million, which is a first run.
Michael Wolff's did really well.
Yeah, it did. And Bob Woodward's Bob Woodward.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to go to a little bit of an early break. But when we come back, race and global warming, polling data, breaking down different groups in America. How do they prioritize actually doing something to stop climate change? We'll have that and a little bit more for you after this break. Welcome back, everyone, to this 9/11 edition of the Damage Report. We're going to turn now to, if this show is about threats, one of the biggest one, although not one that generally gets talked about, is climate change. And there's some very interesting polling data that I want to present to you having to do with how much Americans prioritize actually doing something about climate change. Now, you might have seen polls over the past few years showing that after an initial spike in interest, sometime perhaps after an inconvenient truth, it had started to trend downward. Now, perhaps because of the constant extreme weather events, it is trending up a little bit. But when you break it down by race inside of America, there's some very interesting distinctions. If we bring up this first chart, you're going to be able to see that the percentage of Americans who think that it should be a top priority for the president and Congress amongst non-white Americans has stayed fairly consistent all the way back a decade. But for whites generally, it has trended down before leveling off over the past few years. And you see there that not only is there a big gap, but there's a gap that's widening over time where white voters prioritize dealing with climate change significantly less. I mean, that's a huge, like a 20-30 point gap. A 25-point gap, we'll say, in the most recent data, which is admittedly a few years old. And to some extent, the first response might be, well, this could be an effect of race interacting with party. But if you bring up the next one, you're going to see that gap is available even inside of Democratic voters. There is a significant gap, although both groups are more likely to prioritize dealing with climate change. Do you find this surprising at all, Michael?
I guess so. I don't know how interesting I find it.
Really?
I know you're doing a segment on it, so I think it's
nope, we're cutting out of it. So the next topic.
It's interesting to you. I don't know why it's polled that way, but you know, I guess in terms of what strikes me is that when there are climate disasters of any kind, that the non-white population seems disproportionately affected by it, both the recovery and the actual disaster itself. So, I mean, you saw that laid bare with Katrina, but even since then, you know, it's not just minorities; it's poor white people living in, you know, in tornado zones in predominantly white states. But I don't know what it accomplishes, other than maybe it's a way of getting people to pay attention to climate change, you know, and how important climate is, more to keep polling it in this way and find what the inroads are. I know, you know, we both kind of worked near and around and for Al Gore at one time, and one of the things that I asked him when I had the opportunity to talk to him was, that why isn't this an issue? You know, why are we not talking more about climate? Why don't people run on it? Why don't people care? People don't run on it, and it's very difficult because it doesn't affect them right in the moment. They feel like it's not something like a job and the economy and immigration and, you know, what have you, all the other issues that are at top of mind, guns. But it's because it's gradual and it's inaccessible. It only hits you when it hits you. And you know, maybe this is a way of changing that tide to get people attuned to it and aware of it. So I'm a little less cynical about the poll than I was when I first heard it, you know, why they polled it. But it's not surprising to me that would. I'm not blown away by that, you know.
Yeah, I mean, look, you could be right that, again, it's something that is sort of in the background. But it's also possible that because of the media at least linking the increasing frequency and severity of extreme weather events to climate change, people might be starting to recognize it hitting them more often.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, that's the thing. And the more it goes on, the more people. But I don't. There are very few voters to change that tide is what I was talking about. The number of voters who go in there with climate change being their number one issue mm-hmm. or their number two issue. That's one of the things that is elusive. And if it were, it would be very helpful because you would get the kind of change that's needed. But it's also a gradual cure that can be implemented, and people want to go in there, vote, and have something happen right away. That's problematic.
Which is why every time I talk about this, I talk about the need to stress not just our responsibility to deal with the problem, but also the opportunity implicit in dealing with the problem.
Right.
That, you know, investing in renewable energy and things like that, other sorts of technologies that would be necessary to deal with climate change, are jobs programs right now. That you don't get those jobs in 70 years. You get them when you invest the money. That could be next year. And politicians are constantly running on various things that they say will stimulate the economy or jobs growth. I would reflavor it around climate change. And that way, you not only get the jobs, you also hopefully deal something about this problem.
Right. And I think that, you know, a good thing to compare it to is infrastructure, right? I mean, that's a jobs creator that puts money in. But you see the new road the next day, right?
That's true.
And you don't with climate change. And
if it's a turbine, if it's a solar cell.
No, John, I'm with you 100%, but I'm saying from the strictly political side of it, because I don't get why I understand it now better why they don't make it that. But I don't get why they haven't made inroads into that, which is why I guess now this is more important to see that there are avenues into making this an issue. But listen, you get turbines, but you don't change the climate overnight, right? Mm-hmm. You can build a bridge in context overnight, right? You can see the construction starting the next day, and oh my God, in a year and a half or 4 years, you see there's someone going over a bridge.
Yeah,
that's how politics works.
It's the way that humans think.
I would say that
with the policies we choose, we are changing the climate. Which direction are we going to change it in?
Right.
Like, how many politicians have run based on let's build more, oil derricks, drill, baby, drill?
Of course.
That is a call to stimulate the economy, supposedly, although I would dispute that, while also changing the climate. Not necessarily in ways that are immediately obvious, but they are out there. The reason I find this data interesting is I think there are a couple of ways that we can simultaneously think about climate change. Some people pitch concerns about climate change and the desire to do something about it as because this is not something that affects us every day, at least in a way that we can recognize. It does, but we can't recognize it. And there are other concerns that are more immediate. This is sort of an ivory tower position to hold. Or this is something that libs on the coast want to deal with. And yet, it's not necessarily those sorts of people who actually prioritize it when you ask them. And as you point out, with climate change, with extreme weather events, with anything having to do with the environment, people of color are always going to be hurt more by it when it happens and suffer more in the wake of it because the government is not going to prioritize the recovery. Let's just dispense with that myth. We saw that with Puerto Rico and Texas. You had terrible hurricanes that affected both places. We put money and resources and especially media attention into one. But if any of that came for the other, it took months and hundreds, if not thousands of people had already died by that point.
Right.
And if we can bring up this next picture, you're going to see a cover from The Guardian talking about another reason that generally non-white Americans are going to be more affected by this, not just in America, but around the world, with heat being the next big inequality issue. And some stats for you. Last year, Hawaiian researchers projected that the share of the world's population exposed to deadly heat, heat that would actually kill like it did this year in the heat waves, for at least 20 days a year will increase from a third of the population to two-thirds more than it by 2100 if greenhouse gas emissions are allowed to grow. They also point out, and this is the scary part, that they'll rise by 50% even if we do drastic reductions. So buckle up for the next 70 years or so.
Well, that's the old damned if you do, damned if you don't.
Yes.
You know.
Less damned if you do,
right,
though.
Less damned. Yeah.
So, and as I like to point out, less damned and less evil are better than more damned and more evil.
Right.
Dark topic. Okay, let's move on to another one, though, voter suppression. So 5 years ago...
Here's a great topic.
It's a fun one, yes. 5 years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down some key parts of the Voting Rights Act, arguing that they were no longer necessary. That was a stupid position to take at the time, and all that we've learned since then shows that they were wrong in doing that, although they were also lying about why they did it. Nearly 1,000 polling places have been shut down around the country since then, predominantly, shockingly, in the South, and generally, and this is going to blow your mind, in non-white areas. It turns out that there were apparently way too many excess polling places in traditionally African-American voting areas. They had apparently just been cropping up, reproducing uncontrollably, and needed to be culled. And so they've done that. Local officials have shuttered 868 polling places in just 3 years. And you might recall us our coverage about a month ago, less than that. 10 counties with large black populations in Georgia closed polling places after a white elections consultant recommended it so that they could save money. But thankfully, there was enough pushback against this that most of those polling places were in fact reopened. But this is now a trend. It's not just in Georgia, and it's not just at one time. It's across significant portions of the country over the course of years, and we can see the pattern. We know which sorts of polling places they're shutting down.
Yeah, I was just in North Carolina doing a story on redistricting and what their court fights. And the head of the North Carolina GOP said to me, Dallas Woodhouse is his name. He said that this should be kept out of the courts. That this is these are arguments for the legislature. Well, when the legislature lets you down, and the courts are your only haven, and that's where these things are happening. I mean, that what happened in Georgia was a little bit different because it happened because of a public outcry about it. But the courts are the last great hope for these places. And then what you see. Not just what the Democratic Senate is allowing to have, or the Republican Senate is allowing to happen without Democratic pushback, but you see the kind of justices that this president puts in. It's a long way from being able to solve this problem because
or having any interest in solving it.
Well, but I mean, there are always going to be plaintiffs, but the plaintiffs are going to have a very, very difficult time being heard because of the way the court's being shaped now.
Yeah, but only for like 30 years.
Right, that's the thing. Yeah, only for 30 years.
In 30 or so years, we'll have another chance to flip the Supreme Court.
Right, it's been over 50 years since the Civil Rights Movement. So
So what's another 30?
Right.
It doesn't really matter that we lost this opportunity a couple of years ago. Yeah. It's going to be just fine. Don't worry about it. That's bad. We're going to be keeping an eye on that, especially as we move closer to the election. We need to be cognizant of all of the different things that are contributing to lower voter turnout, lower voter really empowerment to do something. Even if they have the interest, can they actually act on it? Can they change things? People are working hard across the country to stop them from doing that.
The most annoying political maxim or saying or cliche or whatever is a turn of phrase. I don't know what it is. Elections matter. It is the truest, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so many things that people say, it'll all come down to turnout, right? Mm-hmm. Not always the case. People, the same number of turnout pretty much. But and of course, it's going to come out to turnout because that's what an election
is. It's going to come out to votes.
Right, yeah. It's whoever has the most. But elections matter. When you look at the courts and you look at what's happening to the judicial system, it's a disaster.
It is a disaster. That's the theme. The damage report. It's a disaster.
Well, there you go. Damage,
okay.
Right?
There you go. Okay, we're going to take another break. When we come back, hopefully we'll be joined by Wesley Bell, soon-to-be county prosecutor for St. Louis, to talk about criminal justice reform after this. Welcome back, everyone. Unfortunately, we're not able to connect with Wesley Bell, but hopefully in a future episode we will have that because it's an important conversation that I definitely want to have. But there is a lot more to cover. So I woke up to a story about one of the Republican plans that they say they want to do before the midterms. I don't see how that's remotely possible. And I wish that they would try because their plan is they want to do a second round of tax cuts estimated to cost at least $2 trillion. And that's with the tricky conservative math where they pretend things that have never actually played out the way that they say it will. Their tax reform 2.0 aims to make permanent the tax cuts for individuals that President Trump signed into law back in December of 2017, including the law's temporary reductions in individual filers' rates, a doubling of the child tax credit, and cuts to the estate tax paid by a small fraction of the wealthiest families. So that estate tax that was, it was only temporary. The next year, they're already trying to make it permanent. God knows what will happen in 4 or 8 years if they still have a Republican president.
Yeah. And listen, this is sort of contrary to what I've been hearing on the road, too, is that people are talking, Republicans are very proud of the tax cuts. They think that's their key to victory. They're not finding traction on anything else. And so
are they finding traction on that?
They are within their own constituency. It doesn't seem like they're winning a lot of other people over, because healthcare is still the number one thing that I'm seeing people talk about, and the tax cuts don't address that. In fact, they address it in destructive ways. But what's contrary to it is that you are, you know, it, I just don't know. This is a politically tone-deaf White House. And the idea that they got there because they were tone-deaf is supportable, right? I mean, they went against every normal behavior that you do when you're running for the White House. That's what got Trump there. For example, I felt this when he cut, when he froze federal pay wages a few weeks ago. How stupid is that? You have three Virginia congressional races, right? All touching Northern Virginia, which is where all these federal workers are. But I could see him saying, well, you know, doesn't matter what we do, we're still going to win. This is going to matter, because this is starting to turn the other way. Democrats and independents are upset about these tax cuts.
Yeah, it's amazing to me that presumably, so you talk to way more politicians than I do, especially more Republican politicians. I have little interest in solving myself in that way. But they actually believe that this tax cut bill will not just somehow be popular amongst regular Republicans, but will actually help them.
Yeah, they do.
Have they been looking at the weirdest of ways since then?
But that's what I'm talking about, the tone deafness of it, right? Denver Riggleman, who's running for Congress in Virginia, in the 5th District of Virginia, he's running for Tom Garrett's open seat. He got on the map because of this Bigfoot erotica thing, which there's not, you remember him? There wasn't a lot there for that. But he touted the tax cuts when criticized for moving his distillery operations to Pennsylvania from Virginia. He said, were it not for these tax cuts, I wouldn't have been able to do that. Yet he's running for Congress in Virginia.
So if it wasn't for the tax cut bill that I like, I would not have been able to take jobs out of my district,
And send them elsewhere, right? And yet they feel these tax cuts are what's spurring business and you don't see it. I mean, the numbers don't support that at all. But there's an electorate there that wants to believe that tax cuts are the best thing in America. Yeah. You
know? Well, I've got some numbers for them, because I know that if you watch or listen to the Damage Report, it is for large numbers with some context. Making the individual tax cuts permanent that they're currently talking about would add $675 billion to the federal deficit in just a three-year period after the – remember, the tax bill they already passed adds trillions. This would also add $675 billion. So you're getting towards $3 trillion there. That's for that one part of it, just the individual tax cuts. And then starting in 2026, the cuts would cost the federal government an extra $165 billion a year, which is just like, I'm thinking of some political numbers that I've heard recently. That's two of Bernie Sanders' 4 years of public education freeze. Two of them. You could do, every student could go to 2 4-year programs every year just for this extra thing that they're trying to do. And this bill, maybe some Republicans like it, but it is overall very unpopular. It's far more popular than it should be. It should have a 1% approval rating, because the 1% and CEOs should love it. I understand that. Everyone else should hate it. And more people are starting to. Absolutely devastating numbers.
Republicans
really
used to be deficit hawks, right?
I mean, Trump says he was going to eliminate it.
And Gary Cohn, according to the book, was agog at what Trump's suggestion would have been on the Federal Reserve, because it would have created so much debt. I have to assume that Gary Cohn would have liked what he's reading here with these tax cuts. The two just don't meet.
So that's not enough financial. I want to give you one more financial bit of political news. So to the director, if you could, in the Ted Cruz section, the last graphic, the figure showing the line snaking up, could we bring that up actually? Because Ted Cruz, he's now, Beto O'Rourke in one poll was just 1 point down on him. That's the independent expenditures in support of Ted Cruz. So it's about $1 billion. It had been, you know, back to March of this year and started going up. And look at how it shoots up just over the past week or two of recorded information. He can try to pretend to be strong or whatever, or brave or whatever. They are terrified of Beto O'Rourke and his chances in Texas.
You knew that before these numbers. He challenged him to debates.
Yeah, which he would not have otherwise done.
And now John Cornyn is unleashing another set of another allotment of money. John Cornyn can't stand Ted Cruz, his colleague from Texas, senator. He's unleashing a lot more money from his coffers into Cruz's coffers. They're worried.
By the way, if you want to waste a couple of minutes and laugh a little bit, search for John Cornyn, Big John, a political ad that was pretty. Do you remember that?
I do.
We'll play it at some point on the show.
Yeah, it's great.
Okay, so we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to look back a little bit on 9/11, our experiences at the time. Close out the show with that after this. So, of course, it is 9/11, and it's been some time since that. It's crazy to think that there could conceivably be a person who was born after that who's going to college, at least next year, if not this year, maybe if they went a little bit early. It's been a while, but obviously for those of us who experienced it, for those who grew up in that time, it's just about the most significant possible political event. Now, you are from New York. And so I just wanted to ask you, and maybe we talk a little bit about what that experience was like, reflecting.
Yeah, I was in Los Angeles. It's very strange because when something happens, I'm a New Yorker. I grew up in New York City in Manhattan. And when something happens in New York, as horrible as that day was, I hated not being there. I hated not being part of a community that I still, and to this day, feels like home to me, and my family is all there. And so, of course, there's the worry. And I lost people I knew that day, one who I knew better than the other three. But I was on the phone with his brother. His brother. They had two brothers. One was working at Cantor Fitzgerald on the top floor, the 105th floor, I guess, just below the restaurant. And another brother was working one of the other World Trade Center buildings, like World Trade Center 4 or something like that. And I was on the phone with him. We don't know where Glenn is, because I knew Glenn worked on the roof, on the top of the tower. But we found Peter. Peter jumped onto a boat and went out into but they didn't know where Peter was either for the longest time, so they thought their two brothers were gone. But they never believed it, right? It was just such an unbelievable thing. Those pictures that were up missing, you remember the people just went to Kinko's and Xerox pictures, littered the city of every billboard, missing, have you seen, have you seen? And you saw the devastation, and if you were objective to it, you saw what happened, and you felt so badly, obviously, for these people who were looking, but you knew when you saw the reality that they weren't going to be finding. And I was speaking to someone as that was happening, and it was horrendous. So I felt, badly not to be there for New York, but also because I had, I knew four people who lost their lives, and I knew their families. And
I did not actually know that.
Yeah.
I don't know that we've ever talked about 9/11.
We may not have.
That's
because it's the first year of the damage report.
Yeah, that's true. So I think my experience is very similar to probably a lot of people who are of a certain age around when this happened. I grew up in Connecticut. I was going to college at UConn. I was in my second week of college, I think, when it happened. So I didn't actually know anyone there. I knew some people in New York that were all absolutely fine. No losses or anything like that. But up until this point, I didn't think about politics. I didn't care about politics. I couldn't have told you if the president was a Democrat or a Republican. And then this happens, and we're watching it. I was in a quad, a study room converted to house four people. So everyone on the floor, basically, they could fit, came into our big room to watch it. And like the pace of politics afterward sped up horribly. Obviously, things like the Patriot Act, the run-up to the war with Afghanistan, the war with Iraq. And all of it wasn't just happening faster and was more significant, but it suddenly seemed significant to us. And we were forced to care about this. We were forced to see that there were groups on campus fighting and arguing about these issues, about the war. There was an anti-war movement on my campus, obviously. And none of this is anything that I had thought about. And with a lot of people, our lives were all affected by this. Some were crafted or at least redirected by this. And I think for me, I might have continued on blissfully unaware of politics and the significance of any of this if not for this horrific tragedy.
Yeah.
That obviously still affects so many different areas of government policy to this day. I saw a report, and I think this is very much a lowball estimate, that we've spent $1.5 trillion on the wars that we started after 9/11, obviously.
That seems low. That does.
It does seem very low. I saw something like 10,000 confirmed cases of the cancer caused by exposure to the dust and the debris from 9/11. Like, this was a long time ago, but it still affects people's lives. People are still dying because of what happened that day.
Yeah, it was terrible. I mean, it obviously was terrible, but it was terrible because of what it made the country have to do. I mean, not have to do, but it was the direction that it sent us to.
Yeah.
So the loss of life that eclipsed what was lost on that day because of
far
what happened.
Well,
because
both of what inside happened, and outside of America.
What happened on that day is, yeah, it's...
Yeah. Yeah, and I think there were some things like New York seemed to come together. There was some sense of unity of purpose. But that sense of unity of purpose was, I would say, purposefully manipulated by a lot of politicians. And I think a lot of the negative repercussions of 9/11 in terms of what it led to, we are still battling to take us back to the norms that we had before then.
Right.
In terms of Islamophobia and
yeah,
things like that.
That's true. That's true. I mean, there wasn't just this sort of political happiness either, though. You have to remember Bush was president and people were still pissed.
That's true.
And that's
true.
A big part of it.
So, dark time, obviously. Thank you for joining.
Yeah. Happy to be here.
Obviously, great to have you here. Thank you for watching, everyone. Tomorrow, we'll be back with more for you. Thank you for listening to the Damage Report podcast, the show covering the true threats facing our country and what you can actually do about them. You can support this free podcast by leaving us a review and giving us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or wherever you happen to be listening to it. Every review helps more people discover the show at no cost to you.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.